Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Modern China, a Very Short Introduction, Second Edition, by Rana Mitter. Narrated by Mike Cooper. Publisher's Note. In this audio edition, you may hear references to visual elements present in the print and ebook formats of the book. Chapter 1. What is Modern China? It is impossible to do other than assent to the unanimous verdict that China has at length come to the hour of her destiny. The contempt for foreigners is a thing of the past. Even in remote places we have found the new spirit, its evidence, strangely enough, the almost universal desire to learn English, as knowledge of English is held to be the way to advancement, the key to a knowledge of the science and art, the philosophy and policy of the West. This assessment comes from the book New China by W. Y. Fullerton and C. E. Wilson. In the fourth decade of China's era of reform and opening up, Geiger Kaifeng, at last the clichés of the old Maoist era, the Chinese as worker ants mouthing xenophobic, anti-imperialist slogans while all dressed in blue serge boiler suits, have given way to impressions of a country whose cities are full of skyscrapers, whose rural areas are being transformed by new forms of land ownership and a massive rise in migrant labour, and whose population is keen to engage with the outside world after years of isolation. Fullerton and Wilson's observation that China is reaching the hour of her destiny and that a significant part of the population are learning English as one way to fulfill that destiny seems a reasonable comment on a China that is clearly very different from the one ruled a generation ago by Chairman Mao. However, Fullerton and Wilson did not pen their observations, having landed back at Kennedy or Heathrow airports, on one of the many Air China 777s that ferry thousands of travellers daily between China and the West. They wrote their book a full century ago, and their reflections on what they subtitle A Story of Modern Travel came at what, in retrospect, is a particularly poignant moment in China's history, the year 1910. The China they portray was lively, even optimistic, and very much engaged with the outside world. Yet within a year, the Qing Dynasty, the last Chinese imperial house which still ruled the country that Fullerton and Wilson saw, had fallen. The revolution of October 1911 finally brought the 2,000-year tradition of imperial rule in China to an end, making way for a republic. That republic, Asia's first, would collapse less than 40 years later and would be succeeded in turn by a people's republic whose own form would change over decades as it struggled to define what modern China was. It is a sign of how long it has taken for China to define its own vision of modernization that a travel description from the early 20th century can still have resonance in the early 21st. China is the world's most populous country, with over 1.3 billion inhabitants as of 2013. Its economy grew in the first decade of this century by an average of around 10% a year. It is seeking a regional and global role, with a new political and economic presence in Africa, Latin America, and the Middle East, and has taken frequent steps to portray itself as a responsible member of the world community, playing a role in troublesome areas such as North Korea, where the West has little sway. The 2008 Beijing Olympics marked the coming out of China as an integrated member of the world community of nations, the acme of the peaceful rise which it has been engineering since the mid-1990s. The term peaceful rise, He Ping Jie Qi, itself associated with the political thinker Jiang Bijian, was thought by Chinese ideologists to be too confrontational and has been replaced with the term peaceful development. The idea remains the same, however, that China is finally gaining the role as a regional and global power that it lost in the mid-19th century. Everywhere one goes in China, there are signs of change. Significant areas of western China have been flooded to make way for the massive Three Gorges Dam on the Yangtze River. Their former inhabitants are being relocated and urbanized as China moves away from its traditional agricultural past. In the cities, Baidu, a homegrown Chinese internet search engine, dominates the market which is held by the worldwide brand leader Google in most other countries. Beneath China's strict censorship laws lies a grey zone of cultural production. From underground movies criticizing the Cultural Revolution to pornography, cultural rebels find ways to make their views known. China is now a major actor in world markets. Through much of the early 2000s, China's burgeoning exports led to concerns in the USA and EU about the Chinese trade surplus. The West was also concerned about the strength of the Chinese currency, the yuan or renminbi, against the dollar, with the Americans and French frequently lobbying the People's Bank of China to revalue it upwards. The Chinese current account surplus also means that it has had cash to spend on investments around the world, from the US to Africa to Russia. Yet China is also undertaking one of the most precarious balancing acts in world history. While the country has the fastest growing major economy in the world, it is also becoming one of the globe's most unequal societies, even while its policies lift millions out of poverty. See Figure 1. For the rural and urban poor, higher level healthcare and education are often available only to those who can pay for them. China is also in the grip of a resource and environmental crisis. All across China, power blackouts regularly interrupt industrial production. Globally, the country must scramble for energy and mineral resources. Environmental degradation forces bicyclists to wear smog masks and has rendered the Yangtze dolphin extinct. As climate change accelerates, China has become the world's largest emitter of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. China continues to maintain a one-party authoritarian state and heavily constrains political dissent, yet every year there are thousands of demonstrations against official policies and practice, some of them violent. Corruption also runs rife. There are significant differences between China at the start of the 20th century and the early 21st. The China of a century ago was the victim of Western and Japanese imperialism, in danger, in the phrase of the time, of being carved up like a melon by the foreign powers. It was a weak and vulnerable state. Today's China, while it has deep frictions and fault lines, is a much stronger entity. Yet the similarities between China now and China 100 years ago are startling also. Political instability, economic and social crisis, and the need for China to find a role in a world dominated, even if less so than in the post-Cold War moment, by the West. Chinese leaders, who are acutely conscious of history in a way that has been less true of the American and British governing classes in recent years, would also note that the seemingly moribund Qing dynasty had begun to modernize impressively fast in the early years of the 20th century. Nonetheless, it collapsed, as did most of its successor regimes in the following 4 decades. It is the earnest intention of the rulers of the People's Republic of China that this fate should never happen to them. To understand their fears and concerns, and to understand China in its own terms, the China of today can only be understood in its historical and global context. That is what this book tries to do, explaining the reasons that modern China looks the way that it does. Overall, the book hopes to give a picture of China that reflects 3 main viewpoints. First, rather than being a closed society, China has almost always been a society open to outside influence, and Chinese culture and society cannot be understood in isolation from the outside world. In other words, China cannot be treated as a special case of an isolated society, but rather as part of a changing regional and global culture. Second, it is too simple to say that China has moved from a traditional past to a modern present. Rather, the modern China we see today is a complex mixture of indigenous social influences and customs and external influences, often but not always from the West. Society did not change overnight in 1912 with the abdication of the last emperor, or in 1949 with the Communist Revolution. But neither is the modern China of today essentially the same as when the emperors were on the throne 100 or 200 years ago. Third, our understanding of how modern China has developed should not come only through following elite politics and leaders and their conflicts. Instead, we should look at continuities as well as changes in how the Chinese have come to modernity and the impact of change on society and culture as a whole. What does it mean to be Chinese? 100 years ago, and today, an important question remains. What is modern China? To come to an answer, we need to spend a little time investigating both terms, China and modern. China today generally refers to the People's Republic of China, the state that was established in 1949 after the victory of the Chinese Communist Party, CCP, under the leadership of Chairman Mao Zedong. That state essentially covers the same territory as the Chinese Empire under the last imperial dynasty, the Qing, which extended its reach to the west and north of the lands that earlier dynasties had controlled. The modern state, however, has a firm grasp on Tibet, does not lay claim to Outer Mongolia, which separated from China in 1911, and in practice does not control Taiwan. However, this continuity of geography conceals the reality that China has changed shape over the centuries and continues to do so even now. About 2,500 years ago, a group of independent states that were in conflict with one another existed in the heartland of what we now call China. Literature and history from this period is recognizably Chinese, readable by those today who take the trouble to learn the classical form of the language. From 221 BCE, successive emperors and dynasties united these states, leading to a succession of dynasties that created China's classical civilization: the Han, the Tang, the Song, the Yuan, the Ming, and the Qing among them. They created a civilization in which art, literature, statecraft, medicine, and technology all thrived. However, the term China, or the term Zhongguo, Middle Kingdom, the current Chinese word for China, was not how the people of those eras would have thought of themselves. The idea of being Chinese, in the sense that we understand it, as either national or ethnic identity, is a product of the 19th century. Yet there clearly was a shared sense of what we might call Chineseness between these people, which outlasted the rise and fall of dynasties. What made up that identity? Most people identified themselves with the ruling dynasty itself, as the people of the Ming or the people of the Qing. But what lay behind this naming? How did one qualify as a person of the Ming? Over the centuries, there's been a variety of shared attributes that have brought together the communities we know as the Chinese. From early on, Chinese society was settled and agricultural, in contrast with the nomad societies, such as the Manchus, Mongols, and Jurchen, with which it periodically came into contact. Features of that society, such as irrigation, have also been prominent throughout Chinese history. The size of the Chinese population has always dwarfed its neighbors, and that population has increased with territorial growth over the centuries as well. In very early China, the landmass was occupied by a variety of peoples, but from 221 BCE, after unification by the Qin dynasty, dominance remained with a people whom we recognize as Chinese, often called Han Chinese after the next dynasty. But why did the Chinese think of themselves as Chinese? Broadly, shared identity came from shared rituals. For more than 2,000 years, a set of social and political assumptions, which found their origins in the ideas of Confucius, a thinker of the 6th century BCE, shaped Chinese statecraft and everyday behavior. By adopting these norms, people of any grouping could become people of the dynasty, that is, Chinese. Confucianism is sometimes termed a religion, but it's really more of an ethical system or system of norms. In its all-pervasiveness and its flexibility and adaptability to circumstances, it is somewhat analogous to the role of Judeo-Christian norms in Western societies, where even those who dispute or reject those norms still find themselves shaped by them, consciously or not. Confucianism is based on ideas of mutual obligation, maintenance of hierarchies, a belief in self-development, education and improvement, and above all, an ordered society. It abhors violence and tends to look down on profit-making, though it is not wholly opposed to it. The ultimate ideal was to become sufficiently wise to attain the status of sage, sheng, but one should at least strive to become a junzu, often translated as gentleman, but perhaps best thought of as meaning a person of integrity. Confucius looked back to the Zhou dynasty, a supposed golden age which was long past even during his lifetime, and which set a desirable but perhaps unattainable standard for the present day. Confucius's opinions did not emerge from thin air. He lived during the period of the Warring States, a violent era whose values appalled him and which fueled his concern with order and stability. Nor was he the only thinker to shape early China. Unlike Confucius and Mencius, who believed in the essential good nature of human beings, Xunzi believed that humans were essentially evil, and Han Feixiu went further to argue that only a system of strict laws and harsh punishments, not ethical codes, could restrain people from doing wrong. This period, the 5th century BCE, was one of profound crisis in the territory we know now as China, but ironically, it led to an unmatched excellence in the cultural and intellectual atmosphere of the time, just as the crisis of 5th century BCE Greece led to an extraordinary outpouring of drama and philosophy. Despite the intellectual ferment of the time, it was Confucius's thought that became most acceptable in Chinese statecraft, although his ideas were adapted, often beyond recognition, by the statesmen and thinkers who drew on his writings over the centuries. Nonetheless, throughout that period, assumptions from Confucianism persisted. The pre-modern Chinese had a clear idea of a difference between themselves and other groupings, not least because there were frequent attacks by and on the neighbours. During two of China's greatest dynasties, the Yuan and the Qing, the country was ruled by ethnic non-Chinese, Mongols and Manchus respectively. However, the remarkable resilience of the Chinese system of statecraft meant that these occupiers soon adapted themselves to Chinese norms of governance, something that marked these invaders out from the Western imperialists, who did nothing of the sort. The assimilation was not total. The Qing aristocracy maintained a complex system of Manchu elite identity during their centuries of power. Manchus were organized in banners, groupings based on their military nomadic past, and Manchu women did not bind their feet. But overall, the rituals and assumptions of Confucian ethics and norms still pervaded society. Qing China was at core a Chinese, not a Manchu society. See figure 2. The 19th century saw a profound change in Chinese self-perception. For centuries, the empire had been termed Qianxia, literally and poetically rendered as all under heaven. This did not mean that pre-modern Chinese did not recognize that there were lands or peoples that were not their own, they certainly did, but that the empire contained all those who mattered, and its border was flexible, although not infinitely elastic. The Treaty of Nechinsk, signed in 1689, drew up the border which still exists today between China and Russia. Clearly, Qing China did not lack a sense of territoriality. But the arrival of Western imperialism forced China, for the first time, to think of itself as part of an international system. The arrival of European political thought brought China the idea of the nation-state, and many Chinese came to terms with the fact that the old China was gone and that the new one would need to assert its place in the hierarchy of nations. That struggle is still with us today. Yet the modern People's Republic does not contain the whole of China or China's worlds within it. Taiwan provides an alternative, lively and democratic vision of what Chinese culture is. So does Hong Kong. Then there are the diaspora Chinese, the overseas Chinese who shape societies such as Singapore and whose communities are found on all inhabited continents. China is a continent, not just a country. It is a series of identities, some shared, some differentiated, and some contradictory. Modern, Confucian, authoritarian, democratic, free and restrained. Above all, China is a plural noun. What is modern? Frequently, modern is used as shorthand for recent, so a study of modern China would refer to its history over the last century or so. This book, however, will use a more specific definition of modern, because by doing so, it can get to the heart of some of the biggest questions that continue to face China today. The questions of what sort of society and culture it is and wishes to become. First, though, there are certain ways not to think about modern China. When trying to define the way in which China has changed since the 19th century, it is possible to fall into one of two overly broad explanations. The first explanation was more common a generation ago, when Mao was in power and China seemed utterly to have changed its political and social system. This argument followed the CCP's rhetoric of a new China, although, as the quotation at the start of this chapter shows, this was not the first nor last usage of the term new China. That the old, feudal, traditional and semi-colonial China, a world of cruel social hierarchies, foot-binding, torture and poverty, had been finally brushed aside for a more egalitarian, industrial and just China. The second explanation, common in the early 20th century but banished for a while after 1949, has become commonplace again today. This argument is that China has not essentially changed. Even figures such as Mao and Deng Xiaoping, the reformist leader of the 1980s, despite their coating of communist ideology and mass mobilization politics, were essentially emperors reverting to type. In the countryside today, traditional superstitions, religions, such as the Falun Gong cult banned by the party, and hierarchies reign supreme, just as they have done for hundreds of years. Overall, China remains a Confucian, hierarchical society with an ostensibly communist brand name on top. These views are wrong. China is a profoundly modern society, but the way in which its modernity has been manifested is indelibly shaped by the legacy of its pre-modern, a term preferable to traditional, past. Not that the pre-modern past was ever monolithic or static. China changed immeasurably over hundreds of years, developing a bureaucracy, science and technology, the invention of gunpowder, clocks and the compass, a highly commercialized economy from around 1000 onwards, and a diverse syncretic religious culture. The similarity in many developments in Europe and China in the period 1000 to around 1800 should not, however, conceal the fact that imperial China and early modern Europe also differed widely in their assumptions and mindsets. The development of modernity in the Western world was underpinned by a set of assertions, many of which are still powerful today, about the organization of society. Most central was the idea of progress as the driving force in human affairs. Philosophers such as Descartes and Hegel ascribed to modernity a rationality and teleology, an overarching narrative that suggested that the world was moving in a particular direction and that that direction overall was a positive one. There were several drivers of progress. One was the idea that dynamic change was a good thing in its own right. In pre-modern societies, the force of change was often feared as destructive, but the modern mindset welcomed it. In particular, an acceptance and enthusiasm for progress through economic growth and later industrial growth became central to the development of a modern society. Particularly in the formulation of the Enlightenment of the 18th century, the idea of rationality, the ability to make choices and decisions in a predictable, scientific way, also became crucial to the ordering of a modern society. Modernity also altered the way in which members of society thought of themselves. Society was secularized. Modernity was not necessarily hostile to religion, but religion was confined to a defined space within society rather than penetrating through it. The individual self, able to reason, was now at the center of the modern world. At the same time, the traditional bonds that the self had to the wider community were broken down. Modern societies did not support the old feudal hierarchies of status and bondage, but rather broke them down in favor of equality, or at any rate, a non-hierarchical model of society. Above all, societies are modern in large part because they perceive themselves as being so. Self-awareness, enlightenment, is central to modernity and the identities that emerge from it, such as nationhood. This has led the West, in particular, to draw far too strong a distinction between its own modern values and those elsewhere in the world. China, for instance, showed many features over thousands of years that shared assumptions of modernity long before the West had a significant impact there. China used a system of examinations for entry to the bureaucracy from the 10th century CE, a clearly rational and ordered way of trying to choose a power elite at a time when religious decrees and brute force were doing the same job in much of Europe. At the same time, China started to develop an integrated and powerful commercial economy, with cash crops taking the place of subsistence farming. It is clear that many aspects of modernity were visible earlier and more clearly in China than in Europe. Among the most powerful elements of modern thought in Europe was its ability to maintain the idea that its own genesis and construction were profoundly different from those of other societies. In part, this was because of a desire to create a clear distinction between Western European politics and that of other societies, particularly in the 19th century when imperialist ideology became important. Yet in many ways, the attributes of modernity, particularly self-awareness and its associated use of anti-hierarchy, were drawn from a pre-existing religious tradition in which birth and rebirth were crucial. While Christianity was clearly one source of this concept, having also provided the cultural grounding for the teleology of progress that underlies classic modernity, the ideas of enlightenment, not however expressed as rebirth, and self-awareness emerged much earlier as part of Buddhist thought, and in later centuries were developed within another path defined by Islam. The most strongly Eurocentric understandings of modernity have found it hard to acknowledge its cross-cultural roots, yet there they are. But all the same, China, before the mid-19th century, did not share certain key assumptions of the emerging elites of Europe in the 16th to 19th centuries. China did not, during that time, develop powerful political movements that believed in flattening hierarchies. In the Confucian world, all men within the four seas might be brothers, but all men were not equal. Chinese thinkers did not stress the individuated self as a positive good in contrast to the collective, although there was a clear idea of personal development to become a gentleman or sage. Nor, overall, did it make the idea of a teleology of forward progress central to the way it viewed the world. Rather, history was an attempt to recapture the lost golden age of the Zhou and ways of the ancients, and rather than praising innovation and dynamic change in its own right, pre-modern China developed highly sophisticated technology and statecraft while stressing the importance of past precedent and of order. As for economic growth, while it would be too strong to say that Confucian thought wholly disapproved of trade, the Ming and Qing certainly saw a comfortable accommodation by the state with the idea of commerce, the concept of economic progress as a good in its own right was not as central to the pre-modern Chinese mindset as it was to the type of modernity that emerged in Europe. These assumptions mark a profound difference from China's experience in the contemporary era. Since the early 20th century, at least, China's governments and elite thinkers have accepted most of the tenets of modernity, even while vehemently opposing the Western and Japanese imperialism which forced those ideas into China. As we will see, chapters 2 and 3, the communist and nationalist movements that dominated China in the 20th century both declared that China was progressing towards the future, that a new, dynamic culture was needed to take it there, that hierarchies needed to be broken down, not preserved, and that while order was important, economic growth was the only way to make China rich and strong. Most notably, China's leaders were much more fiercely and uncompromisingly modern in their assumptions than many of their contemporaries in India or Japan in the early 20th century. As Chapter 3 suggests, the May 4th movement of the 1910s was far more eager to reject China's Confucian past completely than figures in India, such as Gandhi, were to reject that society's past. But at the same time, there is a chimerical element to the quest for modernity. Modernity keeps changing, and Chinese conceptions of it change as well. The modernity of the self-strengtheners, who sought to adapt Western technology in the late Qing, is not the same as that of the radicals who declared a new culture in the 1910s, nor of the nationalists and communists whose primary goal was to find a stable, modern identity for the Chinese state and people. Even today, the question of what a modern China looks like is in flux. At the same time, China's newfound strength means that it is in a much better position than ever before to project aspects of its own model of modernity back into the wider global definition of the term. With very few exceptions, all of the warring factions that vied over China's future in the 20th century were modern, not just in the sense of being recent, but in their rejection or adaptation of the Confucian norms of the past and their embrace of a new set of norms that were derived from outside but which were adapted to make Chinese and modern compatible rather than terms which seemed to be in opposition to one another. Although they violated their own rhetoric on countless occasions, China's rulers in the 20th century and the 21st have sought to create a nation-state with an equal, self-aware citizen body. This is a distinctly modern goal. The rest of the book will seek to assess how successful they've been in achieving it.